As I think about the subject of why the European Union needs a new business model, the subject of today's presentation, I'm reminded of the words of John Maynard Keynes, who many years ago said the following: words ought to be a little bit wild, for they are the assault of thoughts upon the unthinking. The rejection by the Irish of the Lisbon Treaty has led to much soul-searching in Brussels and elsewhere in Europe. Putting aside the question of how the European Union got itself in this particular predicament, namely allowing 1 million voters accounting for 0.2% of the European Union's total population to veto a 269-page treaty teeming with bureaucraties of mind-boggling opaqueness, the debate still going on as we speak is not likely to go very far. The fact is that it is not the Irish that are to be blamed. One should in general not put to referenda questions which cannot fit in less than one page, and even that is risking it. It might be useful, however, to review briefly here at the outset of this presentation the content of some of this soul-searching. One can in fact identify several schools of thought. There are those who think, for instance, that the problem with the European Union is that it is too diverse to expect that all member states will ratify any given treaty or wholeheartedly approve any given policy. Unanimity and uniformity are relics of the past, and the sooner the European Union abandons them, the better. This, by the way, would be making explicit what is already implicit when you remember that the United Kingdom and Denmark opted out of the Maastricht Treaty, that the Schengen open border area includes Iceland, Norway, and soon Switzerland, but excludes the UK, Ireland, Bulgaria, and Romania, that the Eurozone has 15 plus members, not 27, that the Lisbon Treaty would exempt Britain and Poland from the Charter of Fundamental Rights, and so on. This list is long. So from this perspective, the way forward is to abandon the unanimity rule for treaties and accept a process of integration that allows for different speeds. All members, of course, must be democracies, there must be respect for human rights, and countries must participate in the single market. But beyond this, countries may choose which policies they are able to participate in, depending on their individual circumstances. A second school of thought goes as follows. This Lisbon Treaty is, in fact, a sideshow. The problem with Europe is that, notwithstanding impressive achievements during the past several decades, its influence in the world is waning because it has failed to implement the sorts of reforms which will make it the most competitive economy in the world. All this hand-wringing about Lisbon misses the fact that the European Union continues to be saddled with inefficient policies. The common agricultural policy, obsolete regulatory regimes, a system of higher education which long ago abdicated leadership to the United States, and so on. Former Swedish Trade Minister Leif Pagrotsky put it very well a few months ago when he said that today, when US and Swiss banks risk collapse, nobody approaches Europeans for support. They go to the Middle East, to Singapore, or China for lifelines. Yes, he adds, democracy and the market economy have been consolidated and the lives of millions of people improved, but, he concludes, increasing irrelevance is staring us in the face. From this perspective, the focus should shift from treaty negotiations, a favorite pastime of politicians, to ensuring that the European Union stops spending more on declining industries than in research and development. For instance, Israel, with a little more than 6 million people, has more companies listed in the Nasdaq than any other country in Europe, by a huge margin. That it makes it easier to facilitate cross-border mergers, to build world champions instead of capitulating to national interests. that it creates a European patent, and so on. In other words, put aside the glamorous work of treaties and constitutions and get to work on the nuts and bolts of economic and institutional reforms. Concentrate on the content and not so much on the glamour and the form. Actually, a third line of thinking says, actually, the problem with the European Union is not that its citizens are confused, such as the Irish. Rather, they are cynical, and the leadership is to be blamed because they themselves are cynical. European Union policies do not particularly address citizens' concerns. An Oxford professor put it in the following way, quote, "There is now a widespread impression across Europe, and especially among the young, that it is in danger of offering pseudo-democracy, remote bureaucratic government, thinly disguised by a European parliament." So, from this perspective, the problem is one of political legitimacy. I think that there is much in some of these observations that is probably on target. There is a lot in these schools of thought, as I have called them, that makes much sense. My thesis, rather, which I would like to share with you, is that the European Union's business model is broken. And until a new one is brought out, the European Union will simply continue to find itself plunged into crisis of this sort. As happened in 2005, when the French and the Dutch rejected the European Union's first constitution, another phone book of a document that even senior politicians admitted not having read. For the past half century, the two driving forces of the European Union have been history and geography. The European Union was born out of the ashes of World War II and reflected an understandable and rational desire on the part of Europe's leading politicians to secure a more stable basis for peace and prosperity, and to anchor Germany in formal schemes of international cooperation. The creation of the European Coal and Steel Community in 1951 was an inspired start, as was the goal years later under the Treaty of Rome, which created the European Communities to focus largely on liberalizing the trade regime and facilitating access to each other's markets. This is not to say that the Treaty of Rome did not have overtly political undertones, and it is clear that Jean Monnet, the community's father and chief ideologue, was then seen well into the future. I have always found his statement that, quote, "For national sovereignty to be effective in an expanding world, it needs to be transferred to larger spheres where it can be merged with the sovereignty of others who are subject to the same pressures," and that in this process, as he put it, no one loses, on the contrary, all gain new strength, to be a particularly effective roadmap for the European Union's evolution. Now, the second driving force for the European Union has been geography. As time went by, new members were brought in, able to abide by a set of common policies. Naturally, this process took in countries in the periphery, and it came to a climax in 2004 with the accession of 10 new members, most of them in Central and Eastern Europe. There is little doubt that this first phase of growth has been brilliantly successful. War among member states has been vanquished. Its members are among the most prosperous nations in the world. Differences are settled, in not always efficient ways, through negotiations and boring committee meetings. And a set of supranational institutions has been created, which, for all their limitations, are growing and showing increasing degrees of maturity and effectiveness. I invite you to read the largely positive assessments which have been made in the past year after the first 10 years of the European Central Bank.